I'm delighted to introduce Professor Rashid Khalidi, and I know we'll have a riveting and moving discussion focusing on his new book, The 100 Years War on Palestine. As editors at the Electronic Intifada, we cover the everyday violations of Palestinian rights on the ground. As settlements expand, as settlers attack, as soldiers raid and arrest and detain and kill, we cover the uprisings in the streets and the conditions inside the military prisons. We also cover the relentlessly brilliant art, music, literature, sports, and scientific advances that Palestinians make under the most absurd circumstances of ongoing confinement and occupation. But we cover the daily routine of Israeli colonialism and military occupation through the lens, always through the lens of historical context, of what brought this or that policy to bear, of which politicians laid the groundwork, and of how a century of US-British imperialist designs on the Middle East have tried to crush Palestinian unity and liberation. And this is where Professor Rashid Khalidi's breadth of work and his new book come in. Here, he draws on his own personal family history and elucidates the impacts that the Khalidis have made in Palestinian political and cultural history, including his great-great-great-granduncle, I think I have that right, a religious scholar who warned of the Zionist project's lethal impact on Palestine and its people, and two uncles who were thrown in prison by the British Mandate authorities during the 1936-39 Arab Revolt. And he weaves his own terrifying experience during Israeli bombing campaigns, where warplanes bombed Beirut with weapons most likely made in the US during the 1982 invasion and subsequent occupation of Lebanon, which claimed the lives of more than 19,000 Lebanese and Palestinians, mostly civilians. Israel's invasion of Lebanon is one of six sections in his book, each zeroing in on critical turning points in the history of Palestine since 1917, when the Balfour Declaration was issued, which, as he says, essentially decided the fate of Palestine. Other chapters focus on the 1947 to 1948 Nakba, the forced violent expulsion of 800,000 Palestinians, and the decimation of hundreds of villages and towns, also the 1967 war, the First Intifada and the Oslo process, and the Second Intifada, culminating in the sadistic destruction of Gaza in 2014. In the 100 Years War on Palestine, Khalidi prominently situates the United States' collusion with Israel since the 1967 war, which was grotesquely approved by Washington. And of course, today, the US will do everything in its power, no matter if it is a Democratic or Republican administration, because support for Israeli apartheid is truly an ingrained bipartisan policy. The US will do everything in its power to provide diplomatic and financial cover to Israel in order to preserve the Zionist project's crimes of apartheid, settler colonialism, and war. Let's get right into it. Rashid Khalidi is the author of many books, including Palestinian Identity, Brokers of Deceit, and the Iron Cage. And he's the Edward Said Professor of Modern Arab Studies at Columbia University in New York. Professor Khalidi, thanks for being with us tonight. I think you're on mute.
Thank you. No, I'm off again. Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure to be on KPFA again. I've been a guest of KPFA for literally decades, since the 80s, when we returned to the United States from Lebanon. And it's a pleasure to be on again. Thanks for that generous introduction, Nora. I'm just going to talk a little bit about the book, and then we'll discuss it. And I think then we'll be able to have some questions. And I want to talk about how I came to write it and why it and how it differs from other books that I've written. As Nora said, I have written several books of Palestinian aspects of Palestinian history. I've written one that talked about the 1982 war. I've written one that talked about the development of Palestinian national consciousness. I wrote one that covered Palestinian failures and successes on the way to trying to achieve self-determination. And I think it's worth a worthwhile question to ask, well, why have you written this book, if you've already written several on this subject? To explain how it differs from the others, I think I have to start by explaining how I came to write it. And that was because I listened to my son, essentially, and I listened to one or two other members of the family who said to me very insistently, enough already writing books for specialists, enough work that, you know, is essentially something that can only be loved by another historian or appreciated by another historian. It's time for you to write something that lays out a story that people can understand, that, you know, analyzes things, but that is approachable, digestible, relatable, in a way my son was suggesting that some of my writing is not or has not been. And I was pressed in particular to write in a different way, to try and make this more a story of people, and where necessary to bring my own experiences into the story. And so that's what I've tried to do in this book. It's the first time that I've written anything in which I've done the writing in the first person. And so especially the chapter that Nora just mentioned about the 1982 war, the chapter about the negotiations that I was an advisor to the Palestinian delegation for at Madrid and Washington, I bring in my own personal experiences. And I relate things that I saw, I heard, I experienced, I was told. I'd never done that before. I had never really tried to delve into my own family's history or the histories of a couple of other families to whose papers or to whose stories I had access. I never really did that before. Buried in some of my writing, there are footnotes to interviews with aunts of mine who experienced things in the late, in the period just before or just after World War I. There are references to, you know, books written by people in my family, but I never tried to discuss what actually happened to my grandparents as a result of the Nakba, as a result of this dispossession and ethnic cleansing that Nora mentioned. I never talked about the stories that my father told me about his experiences working in the Security Council. He was a member of the UN Secretariat for more than a decade and a half. He was charged with covering UN Security Council meetings that dealt with the Middle East. And I relate some of those stories and other things that my father or my mother or my aunts or other members of my family told me, as well as using memoirs of my wife's grandfather, things like that, unpublished. So this is a different kind of book in that respect. I tried to focus on an analysis. I tried to argue in this book that this is not a tragic struggle between two peoples. This is not a tragic struggle between two national movements. There are, as it happens today, of course, two peoples, and those have developed out of two national movements. But understanding it that way, in fact, denudes what has happened in Palestine of a lot of important realities. One reality is this was always a struggle in which powerful external actors played a major role. I try and focus on that by talking about the declarations of war on the Palestinians that are made not so much by the Zionist movement or later on the State of Israel, as by Great Britain, as by the United States and the Soviet Union acting through the General Assembly in 1947, as happened in 1967 with Security Council Resolution 242. What I'm arguing, in other words, is that in this conflict in which two peoples are involved, it has to be understood within an international context in terms of sanction, approval, and support from outside for first the Zionist movement and later on for the State of Israel. I also argue something that, you know, might have been controversial once upon a time. It's in the subtitle of the book, actually. The subtitle is A History of Settler Colonialism and Resistance. So this is a 100 years war on Palestine, waged sometimes by the British Empire, sometimes by other powers, sometimes by Israel, in which the objective has been to establish an entirely new reality, to replace one people with another people. People say, well, how can you talk about it as a settler colonial project when you admit that there are now two peoples? Well, we live in a settler colonial project in the United States. There is an American people. There is a settler colonial project immediately to the north of the United States in Canada. There are two others across the Pacific, in Australia and in New Zealand. Those are peoples. Those are national projects. those are the result of national movements, but they also are the result of ethnic cleansing. They also are the result of a settler colonial project, which in those four cases was very clearly successful. And so what I argue is happening in the case of Palestine is that what develops into a national movement, the Zionist movement, gets the support of the most powerful empire on earth, the British Empire, during World War I, later on the support of the greatest superpower in the era of the Cold War, the United States. And with that support, succeeds in essentially supplanting the indigenous population of Palestine with an entirely new population, most of which is coming from Europe, refugees from European persecution of Jewish communities, and later on refugees from the Holocaust. And I try and do that, as Nora suggested, in a series of chapters, which I argue mark seven different declarations of war on the Palestinians. I focus on one other thing, which I think is really, really important. Well, two other things I'd like to talk about that I think are really, really, really important. The first is that to call the Zionist project a settler colonial movement or a settler colonial project is not some kind of defamation or slur. It is simply to reprise the terminology that that movement used about itself. One of the largest land purchase agencies, which accumulated a large amount of land, mainly from absentee landlords in Palestine, was called the Jewish Colonization Agency. If you open up the diaries or the writings of Theodor Herzl, the founder of modern political Zionism, the person to whom my great-great-great uncle, Nora mentioned, addressed a letter in 1898. If you open up his writings, he talks about this project as a project of colonization by European Jews, of obviously their ancestral homeland, but it is a colonial project in his view, in the view of the Zionist movement for the first 50 or so years of its existence. So this is not some kind of outlandish post-colonial framing that is meant to distort reality. This is a reflection of reality as the Zionist movement itself understood it. I think there's that is one of the really important things that this book tries to show, that in fact the Zionist project can be both a settler colonial project and have as at its core a national idea, develop a national movement successfully, in fact. Developing what is today the Israeli nation, the Israeli Jewish nation. There are a number of other things that I think I could talk about, but I'm going to leave it now to Nora, to let her ask some questions, and to leave it to the people who are attending, if they'd like to ask any questions about this book.
Thank you. That was great. I want to talk a little bit more. You mentioned that after World War II, the Zionists rebranded their project as an anti-colonial one. First, it was colonial explicitly, and then it became like an anti-colonial one. And we see this, you know, continuing 70, 80 years later, as Israeli lobby groups and right-wing anti-Palestinian groups are rebranding on social media as, you know, they call themselves like advocates of indigenous sovereignty.
Right.
In invoking terms like Jewish self-determination and the like, right, to really distract or pull away from the notion, you know, like the bad rap that of course colonialism has.
Right.
Can you talk about this rebranding effort and how you saw it being shaped, you know, since before the Balfour, since like the late 1890s until today?
Right. Well, I think the first thing to understand is that in the world before World War II, colonialism was seen by Europeans anyway as a good thing. It's true Woodrow Wilson and Lenin had both opposed colonialism, but the great colonial powers were not in the least embarrassed. And Herzl and Chaim Weizmann were not in the least embarrassed. They talked in colonial terms. They spoke as Europeans with all of the sense of superiority over non-Europeans that all Europeans shared. Even though Jews were persecuted in Europe, even though Jews were considered lesser beings in many European countries, They saw themselves and were seen as Europeans. And they looked down on non-Europeans. You can read this in Herzl's writings. You can read this in the writings of all or early Zionists. And they were very happy to have the support of the greatest colonial power of modern history, which is Great Britain. Without that support, Zionism would never have achieved the successes that it did. This changes in World War II. It changes for two reasons. The first is World War II marks the beginning of decolonization. Suddenly, colonialism is in a bad odor. Suddenly, you don't want to be seen as the spoiled stepchild of British imperialism, which is what the Zionist movement had been up until 1939. How spoiled? Britain, on the eve of World War II, brings 100,000 soldiers and policemen, much of the Royal Air Force and the Royal Navy, to Palestine in order to pound the Palestinians into submission. That is how spoiled a stepchild of British imperialism the Zionist project was. Things change in World War II for a couple of reasons. One of them is that on the eve of World War II, the British make a strategic shift. They move away from their unbridled, unlimited support for Zionism and suddenly realize, hey, we're going to have to fight World War II in the Middle East. Maybe the hatred that we've engendered in all of these Arab peoples by our brutal suppression of the Palestinians. I give figures in the book for the proportion of Palestinian Arab adult males who are killed, wounded, imprisoned, and exiled by the British. And a huge proportion of that population suffered one of these indignities during this revolt that took place from 1936 to 39. So the British put the whole weight of their empire behind Zionism. But at that point, they had created such hostility, not just in the Middle East, in India and in other parts of their empire, that they realized, well, maybe, you know, we need the whole Indian army fighting on our side. Maybe Indian Muslims being furious about what's happening in Palestine is not a good thing. Maybe having fought large parts of World War I in the Middle East and seeing the Nazis and the Italians in alliance against us in the Middle East, we may have to do that again. Maybe we better change policy. So Britain shifts away from its support from Zionism. And this gives, this obviously is a blow to the Zionist movement. And it leads to a period of conflict between Britain and the Zionist movement. You see assassinations starting in 1944, leading British officials. You see attacks on British forces in Palestine. You see the blowing up of the King David Hotel at the same time as there are a series of terrorist attacks on Arab civilians in Palestine. But there is a struggle waged by the Zionist movement at that point against the British. And that's all that's in the memory of Israelis. An Israeli historian by the name of Tom Segat, in a very good book of his, One Palestine Complete, talks about how the whole era in which British support was indispensable is whitewashed in Israeli memories by that short period of 5 or 6 years of conflict between the Zionist movement and the British Empire. The Zionists are fortunate and are skillful in, at the same time as the British downgrade their support for them, being able to find support from the United States and the Soviet Union, which they very quickly, immediately after World War II, turn into support for partition and support by both of these new superpowers the establishment of the Jewish state in Palestine. So Zionism leaps from being the spoiled stepchild of British colonialism and from being a settler colonial movement to being a national liberation movement, which it was for like 3 years after World War II, or 2.5 years after World War II, after which the British throw the whole issue into the hands of the United Nations. The United States and the Soviet Union bully through the partition resolution, twisting arms, bribing, threatening small countries in the General Assembly to vote in favor of the partition resolution, which gives most of the country inhabited by an Arab majority to the Jewish minority. So the partition plan, why didn't the Arabs accept the partition plan? Well, most of your country is being given to a small minority, and you were given to understand in World War I that you would be given independence and self-determination. You think of yourself as a people. It's again, I argue in the chapter on partition, that this is really a declaration of war on the indigenous majority of Palestine. You've asked a second part of the question, which is really interesting. It has to do with an attempt to claim indigeneity for a population, most of which comes from somewhere else. Okay, most of which is either Mizrahi, that is to say, descendants of Jewish populations from North Africa, the Levant, Egypt, Iran, Turkey, other parts of the Middle East, or European Jewish. I mean, there is a segment of the Israeli population descended from people who really are indigenous, i.e. whose ancestors have lived in Palestine for centuries or more. But the overwhelming majority of the Israeli population is of Israeli Jewish population is descended from people who were settlers, who arrive in the country not speaking modern Hebrew, speaking Yiddish, speaking European languages, speaking Arabic, speaking Ladino, speaking anything but modern Hebrew. For those populations brought from all over the world by the Zionist idea, this is something that they're escaping to, something that has its own logic. But to argue that they are indigenous because of a biblical connection, which you have to actually be a believer to believe in. So if you don't believe that every word in the Bible represents God's truth and is historically accurate, then you're talking about a claim to indigeneity, which is completely false. It would be like arguing that the Bible gives another country to another people, or to argue that some kind of historical claim to Spain can be made by the populations driven out of Spain, whether Muslim or Jewish, after 1492. It's a very peculiar argument for indigeneity, and it's an attempt to assert a fashion, something that's in keeping with things that are fashionable today. The idea of indigeneity obviously has enormous traction today, as it should have in the American context, or in the Australian context, or in the Canadian or the New Zealand context.
Let's dive back in time a little bit. I loved reading about your family history and how you actually went to the family library in the old city. You're going, through cardboard boxes with manuscripts that were dated hundreds of years back. I mentioned your great-great uncle, who wrote to Herzl in the late 1890s, warning of the dangers of Zionism, and saying, I have a quote here, "In the name of God, please let Palestine be alone." Can you talk about your family history a little bit, and this, this connection to your relative who was pleading with the Zionist movement to leave Palestine alone.
Yeah, I start the book by talking about a man named Yusuf Liel Khaldi, who had previously served as mayor of Jerusalem, actually three times, and he was the first mayor of Jerusalem, actually. He was the person responsible for bringing the modern water supply to the city. He was the person responsible for building the first carriage road from Jerusalem to Jaffa. And he was also the first representative of Jerusalem in the first Ottoman parliament that was elected in 1877 as part of the 1876 constitution. It only sat for two sessions. It was suspended by the Ottoman Sultan, the autocratic Ottoman Sultan. So he was a man who obviously had a deep connection to Jerusalem. He had a really interesting background. His father was a great religious scholar. His father had served in various positions within the religious court system, but he sought a modern education. And he ended up later on studying and teaching at the Royal Imperial Academy in Vienna. And so he obtained a modern education in addition to his classical Muslim education, became an Ottoman official, served as a diplomat. The Sultan never fully trusted him because of his liberal position as a deputy, but he got positions all over the Ottoman Empire. In 1898, the time that he wrote this letter, he had lived for many, many years in Vienna. And it appears that if he didn't know Herzl, he certainly knew of him. Herzl was a very prominent Austrian Jewish journalist who had covered the Dreyfus trial and had been shocked by French anti-Semitism. And that's one of the things that drove him to writing the two important works, the well-known works, the Jewish State and Altneuland, which are sort of the programmatic and the, idealistic versions of his vision of Zionism. So he knew of Herzl. He knew of the first Zionist Congress that had just taken place in Basel the year before in 1897. We know he knew this because I found the newspapers that he subscribed to. He subscribed to a variety of newspapers through the Austrian post office. He had served as an official of the Royal and Imperial Library, so he had access to an Austrian post office that was not subject to Ottoman censorship. So he could get the papers. He read in German what the Zionists were saying to each other, and he understood perfectly what Zionism was about. It was not about sharing the country. It was about turning Palestine into a Jewish state. He didn't have access to Herzl's private diaries, in which Herzl talked about spiriting the population across the borders, but he could tell from reading about the debates in Basel and from reading other Zionist writings, including, I assume, those of Herzl, what it was all about. He also understood a great deal about Judaism and not just about Zionism. So when he writes to Herzl, he actually writes quite sympathetically. He says, you know, you are our cousins, we're children of Abraham. You, of course, you have a connection to this land. I mean, who has a better connection than the Jewish people? Blah, 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 blah. It's a very sympathetic, very interesting letter in that respect. And then he says, but there are a couple of problems here. One of them is you're going to cause problems for Jewish populations in the empire. By saying that this is a Jewish homeland, by saying this is a Jewish state, you put everybody else, all other Jews in the Ottoman Empire, into a difficult position. What he's predicting is what happens to Jewish populations in the Arab world 50 and 100 years later, 50 and 60 and 70 years. And he says, secondly, this is a country that has a people that's not going to be voluntarily superseded. So for God, he ends with the quote, he said, for the sake of God, leave Palestine alone. I finish that story by talking about Herzl's response, which not many people have paid much attention to, because it is the most dismissive brush off imaginable. Herzl writes him very quickly. He writes him very courteously. He ignores completely what he says. But there's one telling thing in Herzl's response. We would never think of removing the population. Yusuf Di Al-Khendi never mentions removing the population. Herzl divines that somebody has figured out that that is their intention, and without having been accused of that as their objective. So of course that's not our objective, when in fact we know from his diaries that it was his objective. So, I mean, this is something that I draw upon as part of using the actions and the involvement of different members of my family in the politics, sometimes in a leading role, sometimes just as observers, or in my case or my father's case as observers. I describe a meeting my father had with King Abdullah. I mean, he wasn't an important person, my father, in that meeting. He was a very junior envoy. I was not playing a big role in Beirut or in things that I witnessed. I mean, I met people. I talk about people I met. I again and again talk about individuals I knew, Mahmoud Darwish or Hassan Kanafani or various Palestinian leaders, not because I was, you know, an important person, but I happen to have known them. I happen to have seen them, and I try and give in the book my assessment of them, and then I go through the eyes of others. I use my uncle's memoirs. My uncle Hussein, one of my father's older brothers, was the last elected Arab mayor of Jerusalem. He was one of the Palestinian leaders in the 30s and in the 40s, and he published a three-volume memoir in Arabic. His grandsons have since published a couple more of parts of his memoirs. I use the big three volumes in this book. And his view of the British, his view of the Zionists, his view of what was going on in Palestine, I try and give, not to tell the history, but to put this, what is happening, in the eyes of people, and to tell it through the lives of people. I talk about various other members of my family in the same way, as a way of showing that this is not just some dry story. This actually happened to a lot of people, and this is how it happened. We're not a typical family. My family was, you know, very privileged by comparison with others, but my grandparents suffered dispossession. They ended up living in their children's homes. They were fortunate that they had kids who had homes. But very aged people were thrown on the mercy of, you know, events. And I talk about that a little bit. I talk about other things that happened, not only to members of my family, to other people who I knew and whose memoirs or whose reminiscences I use in the book.
Something that strikes me, I mean, you mentioned Kenneth Fani and Mahmoud Darwish, like these, you know, kind of the various ways that Palestinians have illustrated this trauma through their history. And, you know, and you pick up on, you talk about your grandma, your grandparents' exile, and the absolute and incomprehensible disruption of life and tradition and culture and a sense of place and you know, possessions and land, you know, language. Can you talk a little bit more about your family and what happened during the Nakba?
Well, a couple of things happened during the Nakba. My parents were in Palestine in 1947. My dad had gone off to study in the States in 1939. He was a PhD student at Columbia at the time. He was working for something called the Arab American Institute. And he goes back with his new bride, my mom, who was a Lebanese American. She'd come to the United States as a child with her, with my grandmother and with her oldest brother. And they're planning to settle in Palestine once he finishes. And he's there on a sort of a mission for this Arab American Institute for which he's working while he is doing his PhD at Columbia. And I describe various things that happened to them. Of course, because of the Nakba, they're not able to come back. My father and mother end up staying in the United States. And so I'm born in the United States as a result of the Nakba. I mean, it's not a tragic outcome as far as I'm concerned. The point is, I would have been born in Palestine. They would have gone back, were it not for the events of 1948, I and my brothers. What happens to the rest of the family is that they're scattered all over the Middle East. My grandfather tries to stay in his house, which is in a place called Tel Aviv, which was right to the southeast of Jaffa, part of what is now the greater Tel Aviv-Yafo municipality. It's still there, the house. In fact, it's on the cover of the book, The Ruins of the House, for a very funny reason that I won't go into. The ruins are still there. Most of these places long since been demolished. And my uncles are scattered all over the place. One of my uncles ends up in Egypt. One of my uncles and my aunt end up in Lebanon. Another of my uncles becomes a doctor and settles in Nablus. Another one, which is where my grandparents end up. They end up with him, the eldest of my surviving uncles and aunts in Nablus. Another ends up in Ahmed. So the family is completely scattered. I have cousins in every one of the countries I've mentioned. I have cousins who live in Egypt and have lived there all their lives. I have cousins who live in Lebanon and have lived there all their lives. I had a cousin who lived in Damascus. She's since passed away. I have cousins in Palestine. I have cousins in Amman, of course. And I have cousins all over the place, South Carolina, you know, all over Europe. So a family that was centered in Jerusalem. My grandfather, his last job as a judge was in Jaffa, so he settled there. But he went up to Jerusalem all the time. A family that was centered in Jerusalem is now literally scattered all over the world. I think I have cousins in about 30 countries. So that's what happened to my family. And we were lucky. I mean, we had most of our possessions, the family possessions, except the family library in Jerusalem. And part other family waqfs, pious endowments in Jerusalem, were lost. Everything else was lost. And in fact, some of the ones that we retained in Jerusalem were later lost after the 67 war. Properties were seized after the 67 war. But they had intellectual capital. They were educated. They were from a privileged group, a privileged class. And so in that respect, they were fortunate. They were able to go elsewhere. They lost their homes, but they were able to go elsewhere and get jobs. My dad had an education. Most of all my uncles and one of my two aunts had good educations. And so they were very, very lucky.
Yeah. Sorry. There's a page happening in the hospital. I love how you... you know, lay out these seven distinct flashpoints in Palestinian history. And of course, you know, as I mentioned, you end with the 2014 assault on Gaza. And, you know, through it, you thread together the ways in which the US, as you mentioned, the biggest superpower, then became the enabler and the financier of these, you know, of these war crimes of continued Israeli settler colonialism. Let's talk a little bit about what, and I know we're going to get to some questions in about 5-10 minutes, so put your questions in the Q&A. But I wanted to ask you about your thoughts on the Biden administration and the continued overt war on solidarity movements for Palestinian liberation. Of course, I'm talking about the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement.
Right.
Your daughter, Dima, is the director of Palestine Legal, which is an organization that I refer to constantly. They document what Dima has called the Palestine exception to free speech.
That's actually Michael Ratner's expression.
Oh, absolutely, it is.
Mitchell,
yes.
Plitnick and
Mark Lamont Hill.
And Mark Lamont Hill, yeah, have just written a book on the Palestine exception, yeah, as, yeah, as they mentioned.
Yeah,
it was Ratner who came up with the term.
Ugh, we miss him. We need him.
He's making it famous, I guess.
I love it. I love it. But yeah, like, what are your, yeah, you know, and so these states have passed these anti-boycott measures. There is still federal legislation, you know, and state by state legislation, really taking directives from Israel lobbyists who want to shield Israel from any and all criticism. And the Biden administration has stated that nothing will fundamentally change, especially when it comes to their policies on Israel. What are your thoughts on what we can expect and how the fight will change or will have to change if we want to keep fighting for Palestine?
I really try and reframe the American role, certainly from 67 onwards, and really from 47 onwards. The United States is more than just a bystander or an even-handed broker or anything like that. It's more even than what you said, an enabler. You could argue maybe Truman, Eisenhower, Kennedy, Johnson. But by the time you get to 67, the United States is actually approving an Israeli war. There are people who say it's equivocal what Johnson says, what McNamara says to Meir Amit, the head of the Mossad who comes to Washington. It is a green light. Amit's recollections are accurate. What's in the Foreign Relations of the United States documents are accurate. The documents I cite for the 1982 war are accurate. Secretary Haig gave a green light for a war whose details were laid out for him in May, a month before it started, by Ariel Sharon in Washington. So the United States, I would argue, is a partner in these wars. These are Israeli-American wars. They're not just Israeli wars that the United States, you know, enables or gives diplomatic support to, or gives all the weapons to. Certainly, since the 70s onwards, the United States has been the primary supplier of high-tech weaponry to Israel. Before that, it was Britain and France. And along with that has gone a tailoring of our legislation, essentially to suit Israeli purposes. Financial transfer regulations, definitions of terrorism, most recently now laws against BDS, are essentially written in terms that reflect Israeli desiderata. Even if they're written by American lawmakers or by American lobbyists, they're writing them for Israel, for Israel's interests. And specifically and only with that point of view, the United States is engaged in hostility with people who have not necessarily had anything direct conflict with the United States, because those groups of people are in conflict with Israel and are considered terrorists because the Israelis consider them terrorists. And that language, that legal framework, that wall-to-wall support is something that is, as you suggest, bipartisan. This is not something that is restricted to the Republican Party, which has a particularly lurid, extreme, vitriolic version of it, which is driven as much by highly partisan supporters of Israel within the Jewish community as it is by
highly partisan supporters of Israel within the evangelical community. I would argue, in fact, that the latter are probably more important in terms of electoral weight than are the section of the Jewish community that votes Republican, which is actually a minority. So among some Orthodox communities, among conservative, older, more wealthier, perhaps, sectors of the Jewish community, there are actually Republican voters. But that's not the weight of support for Israel in the Republican Party. It's right-wing evangelicals who have a set of beliefs that are borderline anti-Semitic, but who are fanatically pro-Israel. So the Republican Party is in one place on this, but that is just a variation on a broad bipartisan theme, which involves unquestioning acceptance of a whole series of Israeli assumptions. Israel's security is above everything else, and whatever Israel defines as its security is unassailable, unviolable, and has to be respected. If that it comes at the expense of, necessitates, is based on creating insecurity for the Palestinians, so be it. Israeli rights, Israel's right to exist, Israel's right to property, Israel's right to do this and do that, is understood as taking precedence over all other rights. There is no sense of equality in anything the United States says or does as between these two peoples. The idea that because Israelis have, for example, a law of return, Palestinians should have a right of return is unacceptable in American political terms on both sides of the aisle, at least as far as the party leaderships are concerned. Now, you say, what is changing and what might we expect? Well, a lot is changing. Things are changing in the Jewish community. Things are changing on college campuses. Things are changing among young people generally. Things are changing at the base of the Democratic Party. Things are changing in terms of alliances being made between people who are campaigning for Palestinian rights, people who are campaigning for LGBTQ rights, people who are campaigning for on the basis of Black Lives Matter and anti-racism, people who are campaigning for indigenous rights, and a whole group of other people, other groups of people, are understanding that there are links between their struggles and what they're trying to do. For example, in one of the most recent bills passed by Congress, which was supposedly to do with relief from this horrible pandemic and the economic crisis it's engendered, there's a $500 billion appropriation for Israel. I mean, we could really have used $500 billion in New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut last spring and summer, and we could still use it to get that vaccine out a lot faster. And there are a lot of other communities in this country that could have used it. For mental health, for example, for relieving the drug crisis, for example, dealing with homelessness, for example, dealing with domestic abuse. That's not where that money's going. It went to Israel at a moment of the great, December of this past year. So I think that a lot of people are seeing those kinds of things. For the first time in the history of the American Congress, there's a group of congresspeople symbolized by Betty McCollum. She represents a district in Minneapolis, which is called for Israeli mistreatment of child detainees to stop, and which had 24 co-sponsors in the last Congress. I assume it'll be reintroduced in this Congress. And she'll probably have more co-sponsors because another half dozen or dozen people have been elected on a platform in which they explicitly advocated for Palestinian rights, including two in the New York area, one in Brooklyn, Queens, one in Westchester. Jamal Bowman is one of them. There are others, one in the Illinois, in the Chicago suburbs, another in the St. Louis suburbs. So that's new, that there are people who are willing to actually face an electorate and win an election. Every one of the co-sponsors of Betty McCollum's bill was strongly opposed by the Israel lobby. Every one of them won re-election. The six or seven people who won election against quite strong opposition. One of them defeated Elliot Engel, a passionate supporter of Israel here in the New York suburbs. Another took Nita Lowey's seat. She had retired and was opposed by somebody who was, typically support. So I think things are changing on college campuses. Things are changing among young people. Things are changing even in Congress. Now, that hasn't affected the donor class. You know, the people who give the big money to both parties are very, many of them are very supportive of Israel. That hasn't affected the political leaderships, the Pelosis, the Clintons, of the Democratic Party, the Schumers, the Obamas, for that matter. I mean, that whole, and it hasn't affected a chunk, certainly, of the foreign policy elite. I mean, Tony Blinken is a perfect example of somebody who repeats every talking point, virtually, standard talking point, of the Israel lobby. So we have a long way to go, but I actually think things are changing much more quickly in the last decade or 15 years than they have changed in a very long time.
Oh, that optimism is a breath of fresh air. I love it. Let's go to some of the questions from our audience members. I'm just going to kind of take them randomly. Let's see. Oh, Janet has hi, Janet. She has a great question. It's my understanding that there's an archive or multiple archives in Israel that contain some items that were taken or stolen from Palestinian homes and other institutions by Zionists during the Nakba. Khalidi familiar with these, and has he tried to access these archives? It's a great question.
Yeah, there is such in the Israel National Archive, a section called AP, Abandoned Property, which started with materials that were collected from homes in the big cities from which their Palestinian populations had been driven, Jaffa and Haifa in particular, but also the Arab neighborhoods of West Jerusalem that were depopulated during the 48 war. About 30,000 people were driven out of West Jerusalem, about 60,000 Arabs were driven out of Jaffa, and a similar number out of Haifa. So we're talking 150,000 people from the three major urban conurbations with large Arab populations. They were both mixed cities, actually. Jaffa, Tel Aviv, Haifa, and Jerusalem, but the Arab neighborhoods were depopulated. And after that happened, teams were sent to collect books and manuscripts, which were then put in the abandoned property section, AP, of what was then the Hebrew University Library. It's now the Israel National Library. To that have been added other collections seized by the Israeli army since. So in Beirut, when Israel occupied the western part of the city, in September 1982, they seized the contents of the PLR Research Center. And all of those contents, they were then supposedly handed back to the PLO in a prisoner exchange a couple of years later. But all of those contents were either the originals or copies were kept and are in that same archive. The same thing happened to the archives of the Arab Studies Society, founded by Faisal Husseini in Jerusalem, when it was closed and sealed. The contents, I know researchers who found stuff from that archive in now the Israel State Archives. So yeah, the Israel State Archives is full of manuscripts and private papers and books, despoiled, looted, you can call it whatever you want, either by teams sent by the government and the military teams in the wake of the conquest of these cities in 48, or by the Israeli army itself in 82. I think the Jerusalem stuff was taken in 2002. And I don't know what else is there. Access is possible to those materials, but in most cases, not for their original owners, because many of those people cannot enter Jerusalem, Palestinians.
Yeah. And there's a wonderful documentary that came out a couple of years ago, The Great Book Robbery. If anyone.
Ish Amit.
It's incredible.
There are two Israeli scholars. One is Ish Amit, I'm forgetting the name of the other, who have worked on this, actually.
It's terrifying.
This is cultural patrimony.
Absolutely.
You know, theft of the land is one thing. Renaming everything and pretending that nothing was there before is another thing. But taking this kind of cultural property, the important stuff that I'm talking about would be papers that I saw at the Arab Studies Society of a variety of important figures from the 20s and the 30s and the 40s, intellectual and political figures, private papers, and so on. Musa al-Alami, material of the Arab office in Jerusalem. in the case of the PLO Research Center, private papers of people going back to the teens and the 20s of the 20th century. Mohammed Din al-Khatib, I mean, folks who are historically important. This is cultural patrimony. This is not, you know, the secret archives of terrorists. You know, these are diplomatic archives, or these are private papers of individuals. Khalil Sakakini's personal library, the educator Khalil Sakakini. And stealing cultural patrimony in this way is a settler colonial habit. You know, we had until recently in our museums the bones of Native Americans until they were forcibly returned. We still have a lot of cultural property of the people whom were displaced to create the settler colonial reality in which we live. This is the same kind of process.
Yeah. This is a good question from Rebecca. Do you think the vaccine apartheid will get enough attention to help the occupied territories? Talk a little bit about the current situation now, where Israel is explicitly withholding COVID vaccines from Palestinians under occupation.
Right.
And then blaming
the Fourth Geneva Convention.
Under
the Fourth Geneva Convention and international law, in these territories which are under military occupation, the occupier is required to see to the health of the population under occupation. Israel dodges this by claiming that by the Oslo agreements, a Palestinian authority was set up, but that Palestinian authority has no authority, no sovereignty, no real jurisdiction. And in any case, that doesn't vitiate Israel's obligations as an occupier. So Israel has the world's highest vaccination rate. It's in the mid 40s, I believe, or over 40%, maybe even high 40s by now. And Israel has managed to secure a supply of vaccines for the entirety of its population, Arab and Jewish, for that matter. So people in the Galilee, my sister-in-law got a shot. She went up to Tamra, you know, signed up. She's registered in Tamra. Boom, she got the shot. But that's not the, and that's also true for the Palestinian population in East Jerusalem. It is not true for the population of the West Bank. It is not true for the population of the Gaza Strip. So 5 million Palestinians who are under Israel's complete control, export, import, population register, airspace, underground, controlled by Israel. You can't enter, you can't leave. You cannot bring stuff in without their permission. In fact, a few thousand doses of the vaccine that the Palestinian Authority sent to Gaza are being held up by the coordinator of government activities in the territories. The Israelis have just not allowed it to enter. So that's the hermetic control that Israel has over these territories. And one wishes that what the questioner calls vaccine apartheid, you know, the absolute inequality of two populations living under the same sovereignty in the same land. It's a contested sovereignty. Palestinians don't accept it, but there is one sovereign power, whether you like it or not. There is one state between the Mediterranean and the Jordan. There's one authority, there's one army, there's one air force, there's one set of border controls. Israel controls all of them. And yet, one group within that space, controlled by one sovereign power, is getting the vaccine, and the other group is not. One hopes that this will embarrass them. I mean, vaccine apartheid, how much worse can you get?
Yeah.
You are Arab, you don't get it. You're an Israeli citizen, you get it.
Yeah, I mean, you know, of course, like we could talk about all the ways that there is apartheid. I mean, in the same, you know, what would be a zip code, you know, you have Israeli settlers that are subjected to civilian law, and right. Then you have Palestinians who are subjected to military law.
Who can use this road and people who can't use this road.
Exactly.
It's entirely based on what kind of identity card they hold.
Absolutely. So yeah, hopefully the vaccine apartheid will, you know, be the tip of the iceberg for people to start questioning what actually is happening on the ground. Let's go to, I think, one or two more questions. Here's a good one. What are your thoughts on the upcoming Israeli election in terms of, what is this, like the fourth election in 10 months or something, in terms of what it may mean for Palestinians?
Fourth election since April 2019. So it's the fourth election in less than 2 years. The one
it's
that
amazing.
Will take place in March, next month.
Yeah. What do you think it may mean, if anything, for Palestinians going forward?
You know, one of the things that has to be said about Israeli politics is something that's a little similar to what I said about American policy towards Israel under Republicans and Democrats. There isn't all that much difference between Netanyahu, the Likud party, and the parties to his right, and the rest, in terms of important things, as far as Palestine is concerned. They do differ on the role of the Israeli constitution, the role of law and Israeli institutions, the power of the Supreme Court. There are actually real differences between some of the religious parties, some of the right-wing parties, Likud and other, and some of the other parties on these and other issues. Also the role of that should or should not be played by religious parties, whether people who are religious should be exempt from military service. On those issues, there are major differences, issues that entirely have to do with the internal structure of Israel. But on almost everything else, there's wall-to-wall agreement. No government can depend on the support of parties drawn from the Arab minority, which is almost 20% of the population. So 20% of the population is excluded from political participation or any access to power by wall-to-wall consensus of everybody, all of the Israeli parties, literally every single one of them. So what is the difference between them if you have this attitude towards people who are 20% of your population? It reminds me of Jim Crow, frankly. It reminds me of segregation. It reminds me of the rhetoric of the Trump administration in saying that the votes of black neighborhoods in Philadelphia and the votes of cities in Wisconsin, because they have a minority population, don't count. Those people are not Americans. Their votes don't count. The election was stolen, quote unquote. So that exclusion of people of individuals of a certain group from the nation is a particular form of discrimination and racism, which is common to all Israeli parties. I could go on things like security, the definition of Israel's security. Israel's security is something that stretches from Tehran to Tunis. You can bomb anybody. 8 Arab capitals have been bombed by Israel. That's Israel's security. Israel obtains security by exerting its power 1,500 miles this way and 2,500 miles that way, and so on. Finally, in terms of an attitude towards self-determination, while insisting that in the nation state law of the Jewish people that was passed by the Knesset in 2018, that only the Jewish people have the right to self-determination in Israel. There was a wall-to-wall majority. There were some dissidents on this, but not very many outside of the Arab parties. There was an explicit understanding that meant that Palestinians don't have the right of self-determination in their own country. So there are not two peoples in one country. There's one people with national rights. Now, this is not the first time that we've heard this language. That's the language of the Balfour Declaration. The British come in and explicitly say in the long sentence that is the Balfour Declaration that there's one people with a right to a national home. There's one group that is a people in the European sense of national self-determination, and there's one people that has national and political rights. And there's no other people here. There are non-Jews who have civil and religious rights. Well, that's essentially what in 2018 the Israeli Knesset went ahead and said. And on that, there's no difference between whoever you may call to the left, whatever you may call the groups supposedly to the left of Likud, and Likud and the groups to its right. So I think that the election is important, because whether Netanyahu remains prime minister or not is important for Israeli politics. But I hate to say this, having someone else in Netanyahu is going to whitewash the same old shtick. You know, they're going to be doing the same things. The generals are going to still have the influence they have. The intelligence services are going to continue to assassinate people. The state will step all over Palestinians in very much the same way. The army can commit any enormities it chooses. Of the 2,200 people that they killed in the Gaza Strip in 2014, 500 and something, 60, I think, were children. Another 1,000 were civilians. There are no qualms from right to left in Israeli politics. So it makes a difference. Certainly in terms of Israeli domestic politics, it makes a difference. And it will make a difference in this country, unfortunately, if, you know, useful idiots are persuaded that Netanyahu leaving office is going to mean that all is for the best in the best of all possible worlds. That unfortunately won't be the case.
Right. It's like Trump leaving office. You know, everything's
going to. It makes a difference. I'm very happy Trump has left office for many, many reasons. But are we going to end wars abroad? Are we going to reduce the defense budget? Are we going to deal with a whole string? I don't think that's going to happen very easily without a lot of us pushing very hard.
Right. Yeah, addressing the real root causes of the symptoms that create Netanyahu, create Trump, create Zionism.
Exactly.
And yeah.
Exactly.
And I think that's a good segue into our last question, which I'm going to smush from two different questions. Vicky asks, could Halidi discuss the parallels between settler colonialism in the U.S. and U.S. history and in Israel, succinctly somehow. And then Henry's question about how to squarely confront the question of why the imperial powers, U.S. and U.K. specifically, have been so committed to war and destruction on Palestine.
Those are two really big questions.
Exactly. In two minutes or less.
Right? Yeah, let me start with the second part, because I have to say the reasons are essentially strategic. Israel really got its most massive support from the United States as a result of an understanding of Israel as a strategic ally during the Cold War. Israel, of course, was supported by the United States in 1947-48, but the big money, the billions, only come in the 1970s. The top of the line equipment, the Phantoms, and then later on the F-15s and the F-16s, only come after the 60s. And that's strategic. That's an understanding of Israel as doing things that serve American imperial and regional interests. And that was true with Britain. Britain did not support Zionism out of philo-Semitism. Britain did not support Zionism out of a love of the brown eyes of the Jewish people. Britain supported Zionism because 10 years before the Balfour Declaration, the British had decided for strategic reasons, they absolutely had to control Palestine. And this was a means to that strategic end, which is why the British turned on a dime in 1939. Controlling the Middle East was what it was all about. It had nothing to do with Zionism or philo-Semitism or anything else. I would argue the proof of this is who Lord Balfour was. He was the man who in 1905, as prime minister, supervised a government that passed the Alien Exclusion Act that kept destitute Jews fleeing pogroms in Russia from coming to Britain. It was one of the most anti-Semitic acts in modern British history. He was the prime minister. So philo-Semitism is not love of the Jews, is not what we're talking about. What we're talking about is hard, cold, strategic interest. That's what drives the United States. That's what drove Britain. I'll say something about settler colonialism in a second. And I would argue the proof of this is things that people don't pay any attention to in looking at American Middle East policy. When it suits American Middle East policy, when it suits what are perceived in Washington to be U.S. strategic interests, Israel's concerns are ignored. Israeli demands are overridden. We need Saudi Arabia for X. We will sell them AWACS planes. We will sell them F-15s. We may take the avionics out of them, but we will sell them the planes. The Israelis can holler and scream and tear their hair out and get Congress to scream and yell, and the executive will do exactly as it pleases. When the United States wants to win over Egypt, in order to win the Cold War in the Middle East, to get the Egyptians away from the Soviets, as happened in the 1970s, the United States will run, Kissinger himself, very sympathetic to Israel, will run roughshod over Israeli objections and will force the Israelis to accept concessions, in this case in Sinai. that they would not willingly have accepted. So my point is, the same thing happens with the JCPOA, with the Iran nuclear deal. Israel went to the highest level of interference in the American political process. It got the Republican and Democratic leadership, or the Republican leadership, to bring Netanyahu to Washington for two addresses to joint sessions of Congress, in which he used the highest platform in the land to attack the American government, the elected American administration. So the legislative branch mounted an attack by a foreign leader on the president of the United States' foreign policy. Obama overrode that and signed the agreement nonetheless, because this was, he saw it's either that or war with Iran. This is a major, a political interest of mine. I ran on an anti-war platform as far as Iraq is concerned. And this is a national interest. We cannot afford a war with Iran. This is the only alternative. And he shut them up. So Palestine is just not that important. There are bigger fish to fry in the Middle East. There was a time when Arab regimes, forced by their public opinion, were much more supportive of the Palestinians. That's not the time we're in now. And so Palestine just doesn't count. Were we talking about weighty things like hundreds of billions of dollars for defense industries, people would stand at attention, salute, and let things pass. And Israel be damned. But that's not what we're talking about when Palestine is concerned. And that is partly because of settler colonialism. We are one of the only countries which is proud of its colonial period, you know, colonial Williamsburg, colonial American history, settler colonialism, cowboys and Indians. Many of your listeners are probably too young to remember, but the good guys were the cowboys in every single movie and every television series since the beginning of movies, right up through the 70s and the 80s. And it has only changed marginally, perhaps, since then. The idea that the Israelis are, you know, biblically granted this land and are Westerners, settlers, pioneers, just like us, fighting off these irrational savages, is actually a link between American settler colonialism and Israeli settler colonialism. And there's an ideological tie there. You can see it best in the movie Exodus, which fortunately maybe some of the people listening are too young to have ever seen. But anybody, you know, in their 50s or 60s, unfortunately has had their minds poisoned by that Academy Award winning movie and, you know, its hero, Paul Newman, and the awful book on which it's based. I think there are many, many differences between every instance of settler colonialism. There are no two that are alike. Even two in East Africa are different. Even Kenya and South Africa are different, were different. Algeria is different to any other instance of settler colonialism. The power that the indigenous have managed to retain, the limited power they've managed to retain in New Zealand is completely different, the Maori, than the Aboriginal peoples of Australia, and so on and so forth. Each case is different. Ireland is completely different than any other case of settler colonialism. It's the oldest one. It's Britain's first settler colony, as Palestine is Britain's last settler colony. And they're completely different, but there are some important respects in which they're similar. And that's one of the things I try and talk about in the book, and that's one of the things I want to hopefully explore further in the future.
Well, thank you. And of course, if our audience wants to pick up a copy of that book, we have the links in the chat. It is called, of course, The 100 Years War on Palestine, A History of Settler Colonialism and Resistance, 1917 to 2017. It's always so good to hear from you, Professor Khalidi, and thank you so much for your work. And thank you, everyone, for being with us tonight. I'm going to go help my friend have a baby.
Hey, give her my best regards.
I will. Thank you all so much.
And I hope it all goes well.
Thank you.
Thanks to everybody who joined in tonight. Yeah.